Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode 3 of the Right Dishonourable podcast. My name is Jazza.
My name's Jimmy.
You're getting much better at that every week, aren't you?
Thank you. It means a lot.
We, on this podcast, talk about political and social issues from the UK, around the world, and we invite you to talk along with us on Twitter and by engaging with us on the website as well. But this is the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we run our mouths for like 40 minutes or so and bounce ideas off our heads for lols. Today we're going to be talking about
gay pride.
Well, LGBT pride. We want as many letters as we can.
Apologies.
It's okay. You're a straight man. You're not to know. So I went to gay pride yesterday. To LGBT pride yesterday.
Doing really well so far.
Yeah. Marched with Stonewall. So I'm going to recount some of my experiences there. And Jimmy's going to be asking me whether or not it's something that's needed in our modern day society.
Yeah, roughly that.
Yeah.
And for the second segment, we are going to be discussing Grexits, Grexidents, and Greferendums, or whichever.
Greece. Greece. There's too many new words now being appropriated into the whole narrative.
I'm happy with
Greferendum,
though.
Greferendum is quite good.
Really pulled something out the
it
back
just
there.
Reminds me of the Gruffalo, as if it's like a big hairy monster that's going to pull Greece away from the mainland of the rest of Europe.
Yeah, anyway. we'll see about that. But, and in the final segment, we will be covering sort of another gay issue, I guess, whether or not Spider-Man has to be straight. Whether he can be non-white as well.
So the Sony hack is the gift that keeps on giving. Thank you, North Korea. and we figured out that Peter Parker, who is the alias of Spider-Man, cannot be anything other than straight, middle class, and white. So we're going to be discussing that and whether it matters. So yes, this is the Right Dishonourable. Listen with your ears.
Do you want to take it first, Dory?
No.
Okay.
It'll add to the atmosphere. So, if they can hear me sipping coffee, it'll be great.
So, Jazza, yesterday, thanks for that, you went down to the LGBT Pride March, I guess you could call it. It wasn't exactly a protest.
I'm pretty sure it's defined
sure
as a march.
In London, you were marching with Stonewall and a couple of...
who take their names from the Stonewall riots in the 70s, I believe, 70s or 80s.
In the US.
Right? Yeah, in the US, named after the pub. And Stonewall is basically the UK's foremost kind of LGBT campaigning, like,
organization
group.
So, I mean, maybe you could start by just telling us why Stonewall, like, why not any of the other kind of groups?
Because they asked me, and I've done some stuff with Stonewall before. I think they're really cool. They've got great brand as well, I guess, is quite important. They're the Stonewall are the people that came up with the "some people are gay, some people are trans, get over it" t-shirts, and so therefore are like a really kind of like prominent presence at Pride every year. And I was asked, and it genuinely is like an honour to march with an organisation like that. And obviously they invited a load of YouTubers because they want them clicks, but it was just a lot of fun. It was awesome. And that's the main reason that I go. For fun.
See, a lot of people would ask, particularly now that gay marriage is on the books, I mean, what is there actually left for...
We've had this conversation before.
We have had this conversation before.
Yes. Shall I reiterate for our audio-only audience?
Yeah, I mean, you should maybe tell them what's still kind of
on the agenda.
I mean, there's
a ton. So, like, in the UK specifically, I feel like a lot of people are going to be very complacent about the fact that we have gay marriage now, although there are still quite a lot of hurdles that are create barriers for the LGBT community. Specifically to do with gay marriage, you still can't get married in a same-sex couple in Northern Ireland because they have their own, they get to do their own shit up there. You're not allowed to give blood or do blood transfusions if you have been a sexually active gay man in the past 12 months.
Is that true for gay women as well?
No, it's only for the buggery. It's only the buggery that they don't like. There's a lot of stuff kind of with pension rights. So if you have been married in a same-sex couple, then pension rights don't work in the same way, and it's only for as long as gay marriage has been actually statutory legal. There's obviously still discrimination that happens on the street. I made a video a couple of weeks ago about being catcalled, not catcalled, but being like heckled on the street. And like we may legally be very, very close to equality, but we're still not there yet. And for as long as, because we're a minority, I feel like it's something that always has to be remembered and always has to be fought for. And we forget that the gay liberation movement's only existed for like 30, 40 years.
How do you feel about, say, gay role models in, say, wider business? Obviously, Tim Cook is...
Tim Cook was amazing.
Is the head of the biggest company in the world now.
Yeah.
I'm really excited
about
him. And also politics as well.
Mm-hmm. We're the gayest parliament in the world. 38 LGBT, well, only LGB, but 38 LGB MPs.
So, I mean, does that show that Britain's kind of leading this then?
I'd say we're one of the best. We're doing all right. But also, complacency is not your friend. And that's why stuff like the Pride marches are so important, because they kind of remind people that, like, we've been granted these rights. These weren't rights of ours by default, and we had to fight for them. And it's only since 2005 that we've had civil partnerships, and it's only since last year that we've had same-sex marriage. Those rights can be taken away like that, like, really, really quickly. You saw it happen in Prop 8. You see Uganda now, who is trying to legislate against same-sex sexual activity to deserve the death penalty, which is we need to be vigilant, not just in the UK. And Stonewall is very active internationally, yeah, as well.
I mean, you touched on the Uganda thing, but obviously there's been some pretty significant victories in terms of what's happening in the US right now, and also in terms of
the US has gone really gay, like super gay, hasn't it? It's great.
What about the Ireland thing? Do you see that as that significant, or was that kind of always inevitable anyway?
That was hugely significant. I don't think it was inevitable at all. Although polling always had it in, like, above 70%, we know how it wouldn't be a Right Dishonourable podcast unless we shaded on pollsters a little bit. And it was actually a lot tighter than people were predicting. But Ireland was really significant because it was the first and so far the only time that the rights of any minority had been put to a popular vote in a country. Every other time it's gone through courts or it's been dictated from above. This was people in Ireland decided, yes, same-sex couples deserve the same rights as a straight couple.
Does it not worry you that a third of people said no to that sort of thing?
No, because they will die eventually.
Do you think it's purely a generational thing?
I think
then?
It's hugely a generational thing. It's also hugely, obviously, a religious thing. And it's really clear that this is the way that society is going, to be more accepting of specifically same-sex couples. And this is the thing where, kind of like, same-sex marriage versus LGBT rights, these are two very different things. Gay marriage was very specifically two men or two women should also be able to get married in the same way that a man and a woman should be able to get married. LGBT issues kind of is...
broadens it.
It's like a huge whole thing that where same-sex marriage is like a small part of it.
I was chatting to someone about the Irish referendum earlier this week, and she was talking about something that a lot of Conservatives have complained about, which is this kind of, I guess you could categorise it as this shrill response from pro-gay rights activists and pro-LGBT rights activists, in terms of if somebody says they're either not comfortable with gay marriage or they think marriage should be a thing between a man and a woman, sometimes the vitriol can be quite intense. How do you feel that's actually, that sort of thing is helpful, or is that just divisive and ultimately counterproductive to what you're trying to achieve?
I may have given you a different response to this in the past, in personal spheres.
Sure.
But I think that if somebody doesn't think that I should have the same rights as everybody else, then fuck you. And I don't care if you feel like I have a shrill response. My rights deserve a shrill response. And, like, I'm winning. So. Okay.
But purely as a tactical thing, then, or as a strategic thing?
It's clearly working, though. And I think that people should be allowed to get angry.
Sure.
People should be allowed to think, I've been... not me, obviously, because I was lucky enough to be born in the late 80s and have grown up in a society where being queer is largely accepted. But people who have had to... who have cohabited for like 50 years and had to say, oh yeah, it's my cousin, or we've raised a kid and it's like, oh yeah, this is the child's uncle, not their second father. Those people who have had to live in secrecy and had to choose where they live and choose where they can travel and choose who they disclose stuff to, where they've been repressed for such a long time and had to live lies and double lives. Like, I think that because of the amount of the amount that my life would have been different if I was born in the 50s or 60s legitimizes a shrill response.
But
as
you alluded to earlier, in the past you've sort of been quite critical of this kind of antagonistic, angry, aggressive politics.
Yeah, because I mentioned it earlier, something happened to me a couple of weeks ago where I was verbally abused on the street for showing affection to a same-sex partner.
So is it that incident that's changed your attitude, or
it's a series of incidents where I have felt increasingly like a minority in... like my country,
sure.
Right? So I grew up in a bubble. I'm really aware that I grew up in a bubble where it was fine. I grew up in a small village where everybody knew each other. A couple of older people were a bit like, oh, I don't really understand that, Jazza, but that's fine. I don't know why all of a sudden I grew up in the north, but that was my go-to accent. And I didn't realise how much of a bubble I lived in until I left university, which is also a very accepting thing, and then kind of had to start being around normal people in public places, and I'm not normal, and it sucks that I now feel like I have to check myself if I want to show any kind of affection, and check who's around and think about those kind of things, and that sucks, and I shouldn't have to do that, and so I won't do that, and so like, and that makes me feel angry. You know,
I see what you mean. I just wonder if, in broader terms, there's certain political groups, usually on the right, say, if you marginalise certain political groups, you therefore make it impossible to actually bring about the cultural change we were talking about earlier, the shift in attitudes to being more accepting of LGBT groups and so on. I'm just wondering. It's the question I asked earlier: is being aggressive actually? Does it actually achieve your aim, or does it just make you feel better about it?
I don't think that anybody goes out to be deliberately aggressive. I think that when you feel attacked, then you... Like, how would you respond if somebody turned you away from, like, a bed and breakfast? I'd fucking sue the bastards. Like, because I shouldn't be turned away because of a circumstance of my birth. And nobody should. And... That was a particular story for me a few years ago that kind of made a load of people, perhaps on the right, roll their eyes and say, oh, but if they don't like what you're up to, then they should be allowed to turn you away. No, I'm sorry. If you have problems with particular patrons based on something that they cannot control, then don't run a bed and breakfast. If there's a chance that people from different backgrounds are going to be using your facilities, then don't open your house up to the public. Yeah, I'm ranting.
I feel like we're in danger of spiralling sort of away from the main subject here. So I think you've probably said all that needs to be said about...
Have I? Or have I just ranted? I don't know, Jimmy.
I'm sure we'll return to this at some point. So
I'm sure.
I'm happy to finish it there.
If you would like to give us your opinions on Pride and perhaps like the more zealous members of the LGBTQ+AI community,
you've completely lost me.
then all legitimate like letters in the acronym.
I'm not disputing that.
then please do contact us on Twitter at Right Dishonor. And also while you're at it, if you're at your computer now, leave us a review on iTunes. That would be lovely.
And some stars.
Preferably 5, but if you only think that we're good enough for a 4, then give us a 4. I will begrudgingly accept. Greece is having a bit of a tough time at the moment, isn't it?
That would be fair to say.
So since Syriza, who are the left-wing party that ended up being the largest party after their last election. They got voted in under an anti-austerity promise, an anti-austerity manifesto, and their Prime Minister, Tsipras, is now in the midst of negotiating how much money he has to pay back to the International Monetary Fund and to the rest of the EU after they were bailed out, after the whole country going bust. And there are now going to be a referendum set to the Greek people as to whether or not they are going to accept the
terms of the bailout.
Terms of the bailout, which, if they don't accept it, will probably mean Greece defaults and leaves the euro. I think we can pretty much
last couple of months, there's just been an endless wave of headlines about Greece being on the brink, and various other metaphors about cliffhangers.
Yeah.
Do we feel now is this the end of the road, or are we going to see this kind of strung out a little bit longer?
I reckon they're going to vote to accept it. I think it'll be tight, but I think that the Greek people are probably going to vote to accept it, because I feel having the euro and being part of the EU is a stronger feeling for the Greek kind of commentary that I've seen than them having a non-austere government. I feel, anyway.
I mean, you've kind of alluded to it there, but the tension between essentially just making ends meet and having enough money to survive versus this the ambition that the Greeks have, as you said, largely to remain part of Europe and to remain part of the euro. But the trouble is, from what I've been reading, is that these reforms, if they go through, will make the average Greek citizen even more bankrupt and even more...
So it's going to do stuff like raise the age of retirement from 60 to 65, which... fair? I feel, as a Northern European citizen, that the Greeks have actually had it quite good in terms of like their social welfare state and what is expected from... like rich people in Greece have gotten very good at tax avoidance and have quite a lot of their money offshore, and therefore there's less tax.
Well, allegedly most people in Greece engage in tax avoidance.
Yeah, so. And like get paid in cash, and it's just a real big problem with the country. And can we acknowledge also, as I think everybody has, that Greece should have never entered into the euro?
I think that's been agreed
across the board, right? This is less to do with the pitfalls of Greece, and this was Europe being overly ambitious and being like, yeah, sure, some of our people go on holiday to you twice a year. Go for it.
I mean, are we blaming the EU for what's happened here then? And, you know, Greek politicians
I'm rolling my eyes at you, Jimmy, because, yeah, duh.
Well, then the obvious question is, why should the Greek people have to pay for what was essentially a politician's problem, a politician's mistake, if you like?
I am going to answer your question with a question and say, why should the German people and the Finnish people have to pay for the mistakes that Greek people not Greek people but Greek politicians and bureaucrats made? Because that's what's happened.
The EU is the aim of an ever closer union. It's essentially just gesturing towards a super state of some sort, you know, however whatever word
I always
you
imagine
want.
When people say super state, I always imagine it as a superhero with like a yellow thing across his face and like a flowing blue and like,
well, this would
yellow
be this would
cape.
Be quite a dysfunctional superhero, I'd
it
imagine.
Would be, yeah.
But I mean, in a country, you accept that when the taxes are collected in, and then the government spends money, certain people who maybe have worked harder than other people are going to lose out in the sense that they are going to pay indirectly for other people who maybe haven't worked so hard or have got unlucky or what have you. And that is essentially all that's happening within the EU. It just so happens that we have spoken about this before, but the EU tried to create a country without creating the narrative that actually keeps a country together. The narrative of solidarity and burden sharing.
I mean, it's got a flag, but that's about it, isn't it?
It's got a flag, it's got a
national anthem.
A tiny army, a central bank.
Yeah, and a continent-wide song contest, which obviously is incredibly important with building the narrative within the continent. Do you think that if Greece decides to leave, or ends up getting kicked out of, or decides to leave the Euro, do you think this is as big a deal as everybody is making out?
Well, loads of people have argued that if they leave, it will be really significant because it will prove that people can leave the Euro. I believe we've already established that people can leave the Euro. We accepted that a couple of months ago. That's no longer in dispute, mm-hmm. I don't think. If it ever was in dispute, obviously you can leave a currency.
I think they had deliberately ambiguous wording in treaties that people signed up to when they joined the Euro. Basically saying, you can't really leave, but... You know what treaties it like? It's words on a page.
Well, in the US, there's actually, legally speaking, it's impossible for a state to leave the United States.
Yeah.
But actually, if a state decided the majority of people living in that state wanted to leave, would that principle really stop them? I sort of
self-determination.
I doubt it myself. But
come on, Texas.
And there's probably a lot of Americans that would like Texas to leave.
But do you think that the world is going to go into meltdown and this will be the end of the Euro and the EU if Greece does leave? And if Greece leaving ends up being followed by the UK leaving, if Davkam, which I'm going to continue to call him, by the way, if Davkam fails in his bid to keep the UK in the EU?
Obviously, Britain leaving is more significant, just from a geopolitical sense of Britain as a more significant country. But
ooh, burn, Greece, burn.
I don't think it's as much of a big deal as... I think it's just that there's a lot of uncertainty. Nobody knows what will quite unravel if they leave, which is why they've been trying to reduce the chance of them leaving, because the risk is quite high. But in the event, it will probably not work out quite as bad as people are thinking, because... When you plan for these kind of things, you have to imagine worst-case scenarios, just in case it actually happens. But, I mean, ultimately, I'm somewhat more concerned as an observer of the fate of the Greeks rather than the fate of the EU, which I think will soldier on one way or the other, because there's so much willpower
in
to actually
case,
keep the EU together.
In which case, don't you think that the best thing for them is to leave the EU and the Euro? If your concern is the immediate future of the Greek people, who are obviously going to... I'm going to use the word suffer under the very extreme austere-like regime that they didn't vote for.
Well, you know, not having a degree in international finance, I'm not really...
God damn it, Jimmy, you failed me again.
I'm not really privy to all the ramifications of one scenario or another, to be honest. I don't think most people really know what is the best course of action, otherwise...
Do you think that this goes against democracy? Because the Greek people voted for a party that was anti-austerity and are now having austerity imposed on them by people... who are technocrats and by other governments.
Well, by the same token, you know, Scotland voted in a party at the last general election that is anti-nuclear weapons. Does that mean that Britain has to dismantle its nuclear weapons capacity?
But the EU is a union and the United Kingdom is technically a country.
I mean, the EU is a country in all but name. It has a huge bureaucracy, it has a parliament, it has a central bank,
it is a pan-national parliament. It's not one country,
It functions as a state, alright?
It functions as a state, but is not a country. I think that's...
Okay, well, we're quibbling slightly with semantics here.
I also wanted to very much in the theme of this podcast, recount a... conversation I had with somebody who was also not an expert, who happens to be my father, who was like, I don't understand. So he's really into markets and stuff and invests and all of that bollocks and has yet to make any money. But he was basically, he watches Bloomberg every day and was like, why are all of these Yanks, he calls them Yanks, not my words, why are all of these Yanks concerned about Greece with a population of 7 million? Leaving a currency that has only existed for 15 years. Surely there are other, like, more important, more significant things that are going to be driving markets. So, I put to you, Jimmy, that it doesn't really matter.
You're probably
Why
right.
Why do we care?
Well, we care because of the way news cycles work, in that there's lots of new stuff happening. Mm-hmm. Whereas, I mean, you could argue like the oil price is more significant, say, but that's been ongoing for a long time, and there aren't necessarily the sharp changes, and there's not the diplomatic dinners and the, you know, all of the other...
They love a dinner, don't they? Yeah. Journalists? An absolute nightmare.
So I think that's the reason there's the focus on it. I mean, you could argue that the news is permanently focused on trivia at the expense of, you know, serious matters.
Well, I think we did quite well at talking about the whole Greek thing, seeing as we know very little about economics. This, for any of you new listeners, is actually a running theme of ours, that we are just basically people with opinions and don't very much about, you know.
I'll have you know I'm a qualified journalist. So,
there's deliberately no qualifications for journalism, Jimmy. You know that very well. If you have any particular opinions, if you are qualified in any way, shape, or form to talk about economics, then please do talk to us on Twitter at The Right Dishonor. No, at Right Dishonor. No, the.
Yeah. No definite
I'll
article
it,
in there.
I'll put it in the show notes, whatever. And you can also talk to us on Twitter too. For lols. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can.
That's copyright, dude. We can't sing that. Oh. You have to cut that out.
Oh, I'm not going to.
So as Jazza has, you know, incredibly introduced this segment, we learnt this
Incredible
week...
Incredible being the optimum word.
Amazing. This amazing segment.
I see what you did there. Well done.
We found out this week that... and there's a bit of nuance here, that Peter Parker... contractually speaking, is only allowed to be straight and white.
And middle class.
I thought he was working
class. No, he has to be middle class.
He has to be middle class.
Journalists aren't working class, Jimmy, no matter how much you want to pander to those groups. You are not working class.
I obviously wasn't privately educated, so, you know. So anyway, Peter Parker has to be middle class, white and straight.
So this has been spun quite a lot in the media as Spider-Man cannot be... can only be straight.
Well, this is the other side of it. Spider-Man is allowed to be anything. There are no obligations as to what. I mean, there are obligations in terms of how he can behave. So he can't kill anyone.
Yeah.
He's not allowed to torture anyone. Not allowed to have sex before the age of.
I mean, it's very
16,
Marvel 1990s.
And the way that Stan Lee, Spider-Man's creator, has played it is saying he said, "I'm not opposed to superheroes being gay or from an ethnic minority background, etc." He just feels that once a character's been created, their attributes in terms of demographic are kind of set in stone.
Yeah.
So, Jazza, how do you feel about all this, this controversy?
There's been so much noise about this, about the fact that, oh my God, Spider-Man has to be white and middle class and a straight man. And, no, it's talking specifically about the character Peter Parker. Peter Parker is not synonymous with Spider-Man. Peter Parker was like the original Spider-Man, and I feel like having those kinds of contractual obligations for Peter Parker is fine, whereas Spider-Man actually at the moment is about to, like in the comic books, if anybody follows the Marvel comic books, Spider-Man is going to be portrayed by Miles Morales, who is...
Latino black
character. Which is, like, amazing. Like one of the flagship characters from the Marvel Universe is now going to be a black man. And I feel like the internet kind of read the headlines
Amazing. Are you saying people on the internet don't read the actual story?
I think that that is what happens the majority of the time, that things like this blow up.
But there was a similar sort of furore over the whole idea of James Bond being played by, say, Idris Elba a couple of months ago. And there were lots of people kicking off saying, no way, James Bond has to be white. There was people also mooted the idea that, feminists mooted the idea that James Bond could be a woman.
There was a time, do you remember, before Daniel Craig became James Bond, that people were, like, one of the top people in the bookies was Amy Winehouse to become the next James Bond. This was before she passed away.
Obviously.
But they had her as, like, the third favourite person to become the next James Bond, which I'm not sure if anybody put any money down on that. But you've actually raised something really interesting, because I feel like I feel differently about James Bond to how I do about Peter Parker, but I don't know why.
I think I'm maybe on the same wavelength as you. Have you read any of the books?
Yeah.
The whole point of James Bond is that he is a product of the British colonial era. He's a white male chauvinist. Mm-hmm. Basically, he treats women really shoddily. In the books, there's like a bit of a racist kind of tone to the way that black people are described. Mm-hmm. He's very superficial. He's obsessed with branding, and I feel his whiteness and his maleness are actually kind of integral to his character.
Yeah,
they're not really optional things.
Makes him really attractive as well. It's very bad.
But do you see what I mean, though? Is that for some characters, if you actually change those attributes about them, you actually change the essence of the character.
Yeah.
And if that's what people are going to the movies to see, if that's what people actually like, then I think it's sort of ill-advised to do so. But, I mean, there's other... this is actually quite a common thing now when they readapt old things, that they maybe talk about making certain characters gay that were previously straight.
Yeah.
Certain characters black that were previously white.
Because there wasn't that kind of freedom when those works were originally put out there. So Sherlock Holmes is an example, like all of the queer undertones in there. Actually verges on queer baiting, which is something that I've talked about on YouTube before.
Could you define queer baiting?
So queer baiting is having homosexual overtones or teasing the possibility of there being a gay storyline, and then as soon as the characters are meant to have an intimate moment, it gets snatched away as oh my god, no, that would be ridiculous if two men kissed. Oh my god, isn't this hilarious? Let's go on. And it's meant to be a way of kind of implying queer overtones and being able to get a bit of the pink pound and all those kind of things without actually delivering on there being gay characters in anything.
I suppose the thing is with Sherlock Holmes is that Watson's character is obviously infatuated with Sherlock Holmes. I mean, maybe not in a sexual sense, but in an intellectual sense, he's certainly obsessed with him.
I feel differently about that. But we can have that conversation when we're not talking about Spider-Man. So, Spider-Man, do you think that there's anything wrong with the fact that this was written into a Sony contract about Peter Parker, the character?
I feel at the end of the day the character is the property of Marvel or Stan Lee, if you want to put it that way.
But can they should they be able to discriminate with their property in the same way that Ian Fleming's estate are no, but James Bond should always be white? Do you think that should be their contractual right to kind of discriminate through depictions of their intellectual property?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's acceptable, but I'm not sure I could justify that in intellectual terms. I feel that's kind of a judgment call.
Yeah.
I mean, you might, if you said, oh no, I feel completely differently, I don't feel I'd have any way of arguing with you about it one way or the other. It's just...
I'm really torn, because I think that... I love the fact that we've used James Bond as a counterpoint, because I feel James Bond can be black, but I don't feel Peter Parker, not Spider-Man, but I don't feel Peter Parker can be... I feel so diversity in the Spider-Man universe, Spider-Man can be a diverse character because of who is behind the mask, and so you're allowed to show diversity.
Stanley made
through
it exactly
different...
this point.
Yeah, you're able to show diversity through different characters who are Spider-Man, whereas James Bond, otherwise he would always end up being a white character, and there's no way of showing any kind of diversity or nuance to, or different nuance to the character in that way. Maybe that's why, I think, that extra dimension.
I mean, to some extent, and I do say this as a white, straight, middle-class man, but I don't really care. If they want to make him black, go ahead. I'll probably still go watch the film.
Is the thing. There's been queer overtones, specifically in the Marvel Universe, in comics.
There's a lot of spandex
going on. For decades and decades. Yeah, so, I feel a lot of kids who grew up in the 70s and 80s realised they were gay by seeing Cyclops' bulge in the X-Men comics, and, a lot of the X-Men characters have queer overtones as well. A lot of the women kind of get off with each other off screen, which is everybody knows, but it's never actually explicitly said. And so in terms of, but the problem was that there was still a huge amount of lack of diversity that was explicit. So there was, up until recently, only one or two gay Marvel comics ever. The majority of them are of Marvel characters are still white male. I think it's even worse in the DC universe as well. And now they're doing a lot of things, specifically in the comic book world, that encourage that show like more of a multicolored world that the US has become. So, for example, Miles Morales being a black Spider-Man, Thor is now a woman, and it's now canon that Thor is a woman. Thor will always be a woman now.
Do you, when they do make the characters non-white and non-straight, sort of non that kind of normal stereotypical thing, do you feel that you want them to do something with it in terms of exploring the issues that pertain to those groups, or do you just want it to be like, oh yeah, he's gay, and that's not even interesting to us?
I feel like if they have people from that background on the writing team, they will make sure that that their real life experiences are represented within the comic and through that character.
Do you think it's better that it's just sort of a throwaway thing in a way?
Somebody's sexuality or race, if you know them in real life, is never a throwaway thing. That has shaped the person that they are and the kind of experiences that they have had. And the same thing should be true in any kind of comic book character. If Spider-Man is black and Spider-Man is kind of referred to as a hero, and then when he's got his mask on, but then behind the mask when he takes it off and is on the street, will perhaps be more likely to be profiled or more likely to be like a victim of violence or whatever, then that should come through in a comic, because that's actually what people will experience if they are from those backgrounds.
But some people make the argument that, say, if you're writing a novel, to write a compelling female character, if you're a male writer, you just write a male character and then make that character a woman.
Yeah, I don't think that that's right. I feel like there is a certain amount of nobility to writing a gender-neutral character and then deciding to assign a gender afterwards. But I just don't feel like that is what the human experience is like. Whatever you look like and whoever you are is going to shape the experiences that you have. And the more diversity you have in that vein, the better.
All right, well, I think we'll leave it there.
But Peter Parker should be able to be white.
Okay, well, we'll leave that opinion. if you enjoyed what we did, and even if you didn't, somehow you've made it all the way through this segment, so leave a comment.
Question the things that you listen to if you're disliking like 40 minutes of a podcast.
It might be like sort of hate enjoyment, though. Like, I really hate these guys, but I have to listen to them to sort of fuel my hope.
I mean, we haven't heard any of you. So if you hate us, please do let us know. Equally, if you like us, please do leave us a review on iTunes, because it helps us very muchly, and leave stars.
And share it on Twitter, share it on Facebook.
Yeah. Tag us in. My name is Jazza. I'm Jazza John, JazzaJohn on Twitter. Jimmy, who are you on Twitter?
I'm JDE Nichols.
And you can find us on at Right Dishonor and at rightdishonorable.com as well, if you want to read articles that are being written by people.
And aliens.
And aliens? I didn't realise that we were bringing in that feature so soon.
We're very pro-diversity.
All right, bye-bye.